All right, Stragglers. So we're both Mike. This is the famous Mike. This is the not famous Mike. I work at the Babe Ruth Museum, and we thank you all for coming over this afternoon. What we're going to do is chronicle his career. That's what we've been asked to do. And so we're going to probably just go from A to Z and get into all of that a little bit, ask questions, create a little nuance. We were just talking. He has one baseball glove left from his career, and he felt that he lost it or that it was taken. Tell him about that. That's a good story.
Yeah, I've given a lot of my gloves away to coaches and their kids, and which has been fun. And I've gotten, you know, response in the past. Oh, my son's using your glove, this and that, you know. And sometimes kids' careers end. My son's still got your glove hanging in his room. So that kind of makes me feel good. But I saved one glove, and it wasn't a gamer. It was actually a backup glove. The last year I played actually up in Toronto. And this summer I was helping my son, my 15-year-old's team's son, and they traveled up to Cape Cod to play. And, of course, I put my glove on my fungo, went in and forgot it after one of the games in the dugout. And I called the guy that was running this weekend tournament. And he goes, well, we found your fungo, but we can't find your glove. And I was like, well, wait a second. The glove was attached to the fungo. There's no way that glove could be missing. And thank goodness, I think a little pressure was put on him. I said, this is the last glove I got. You know, I can understand somebody want to take a glove. But they brought it back the next day. So I have it with me, and I'm never taking it on the road again. Thanks. Thank you.
So anyway, before we get started, a comment about this gentleman. We've worked together a few times over the years. This is one of the nicest guys in baseball, a true gentleman, and always willing to help, great for the community, and has been such a blessing for the Orioles organization. We're so proud to have you. And especially to have you here today. So as I mentioned, we are going to talk about his career. You were an Army brat, right?
Air Force brat, that's
Air Force, okay. Yeah. And but you spent the majority of your childhood in Maine, correct? Where were you
High
born?
School, actually. I was born in Marquette, Michigan, Upper Peninsula. So there have been times throughout my career where somebody will say, hey, you're an OOPA. And I'm like, what are you talking about, man? The Upper Peninsula, Michigan. I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess I am an OOPA, right? Born there 1 year, and then my dad got shipped off to Okinawa in the midst of the Vietnam War. So it was a pretty interesting time. I think I don't remember, obviously, any of it, but he was there for 3 years. My mom and I went over with my dad. There was a time, a story, my mom said that a B-52 that was heading over to do a mission in Vietnam blew up on the end of the runway, and parts of the plane fell on our house and stuff like that. So, you know, I guess in wartime, being an Air Force brat, Army brat, military brat, period, it's pretty stressful, you know, on a young family. I know my mom, it was pretty hard on her, and I think just the travel in general is incredibly grueling on families in the military. In some cases, I think it teaches people how to endure and become a little bit more resilient. And I think ultimately, looking back on my military career, I think it did help me. I think it made me a little tougher. It helped me understand people a little bit better, because when you're moving from city to city, state to state, you're meeting a lot of different people. And you have to find ways, whether it be conforming, adjusting one way or another, to overcome certain odds and adversity. And as a young kid, it really impacted me. I think when I was in from third to fifth grade, my dad was stationed at Griffiths Air Force Base in upstate New York. Griffiths Air Force Base has recently become famous on a documentary I just watched the other day. Woodstock 1999 took place at Griffiths Air Force Base, which is now no longer an Air Force Base, obviously. But I grew up, we didn't live on the base, just off the base. It was the first time in our military life that we didn't live on a base. So So it was kind of neat to be part of a community, live in a home, have a nice little salt box house with a little two-bedroom home. And being part of that community, going to elementary school, was awesome. And then all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, I think to protect us as kids, I did have a younger brother, they were like, okay, we're moving. What do you mean we're moving? This is utopia. I mean, I was in a perfect triangle. I had an elementary school. I had an awesome fishing hole called the Nine Mile River that I could walk to and catch trout. I had a baseball field in the backyard where we constantly had sandlot baseball games. It was heaven, and to this day, still resonates in my mind as being heaven. It was unbelievable. Now, obviously, it was a time in my life, third to fifth grade, young kid, very impressionable, and it hurt, man. I felt that move, and to this day, I feel like, why did we screw things up and leave? Stittville, New York was the name of this town. Stittville, New York, small little American town. Still have the Pledge of Allegiance on a sign in the town because my son and I, who lives in Maine right now, is 22 years old, we were doing some college trips, and we went up to Maine, and I told him on the way back, I said, you think we can go to Stittville? Because my whole life I had talked about it, I had never gone back. And we went. We went to Stittville, and there was the same Pledge of Allegiance sign right on the corner, the four corners, right down the street from the Nine Mile River that I used to fish. The town hasn't changed one bit. My old little house is still there. But anyway, I know I get a little off track.
Okay.
But that's where I learned to play baseball, too, in Stittville, New York. And there's a big reason why I think I learned to play the right way, because of sandlot baseball. It's a lost art nowadays. Kids just don't play in the backyard. They don't get their neighborhood kids together and play. And that's where I kind of learned. We learned from each other. You know, guy would scream on me about not running hard down the first baseline, so I forever hustled after that. Like, I didn't want to get called out in front of my friends and things. But yeah, that was an awesome experience in Stittville. We ended up moving to, actually back to Maine for a year. Maine was always considered our home base because my mom was from Maine. My dad actually started his Air Force career in Dow, at Dow Air Force Base in Bangor, Maine. Met my mom, got married, went to Marquette, and then we used to go back there and transition. From Maine, we went down to New Hampshire for 3 years, Pease Air Force Base. He retired, and we moved to Maine. We built a log cabin, took a summer off, built a log cabin in Maine. And my sophomore, junior, and senior year, I went to high school at Hamden Academy, just outside of Bangor, Maine. And got recruited to go to the University of Maine, which was an actual hotbed for collegiate baseball. And I'll remind you all, because I know you don't remember, but the Black Bears from 1980 to 1986 went to the College World Series 5 out of 6 years. Right? Now, thank you. The regional formats, were structured a little bit differently, and Maine got to host regionals. Instead of having to go down and play in Mississippi State, you know, we played some tough schools that might have had one or two potential big league players on it, but we didn't have to play the SEC. They, of course, in turn, have changed that regional format. Maine has never been back. They haven't been back to the World Series. But it was an awesome experience. I got to go 2 out of the 3 years I was at Maine and played with Billy Swift, former number one pick, had a great major league career. There were many guys that got drafted off the our Maine teams. Not a lot made it to the big leagues, but we had a great time learning the right way to play the game. Our coach was John Lincoln, an institute up there. Incredible instructor of fundamental baseball. Most of our training was done indoors, so all you could do is really work on fundamentals. I think one of the most important drills we ever did, a drill we called Little League, where he brought everybody in close, smaller than this room, and had everybody go to their position, and we would go through every play. Ball hit in the gap, where do you go? And you just take a couple steps, just so you know exactly where you go. You don't get all spread out, confused on the field. Everybody is held accountable because you're right next to your buddy, but you're lining up and everything was perfect. That might have been the most impactful baseball drill I've ever done. Made me aware of every situation on the field. And I think it really helped me, you know, kind of stand out as an undrafted player in the Oakland A's.
So when you you finished college, you were playing shortstop?
I was, yes.
Okay, so you're a shortstop. You get out of college, and then you go to play Cape Cod League. Did that happen that
My junior year. My junior year, I was invited to play in Cape Cod. And, you know, obviously the most prestigious collegiate summer league in the country. And
was it that good, the level of talent?
Awesome. Unbelievable, really. Yeah, Cape Cod's the place to go if you're a college player. It really is. And but my hope was, because we were going to Omaha again, we just punched another ticket to go to Omaha and play in the College World Series. And we had a really good team, and I had the best year I ever had collegiately. I hit 365. I don't know how many. I didn't hit a ton of home runs, but I set a record for most hits in a season. I played shortstop, helped lead the team in the College World Series. I was asked by Matt Murillo, who was the scouting director at the time, if I was signable. Because a lot of players at the University of Maine, Billy Swift included, went back for his senior year. Maine had had the reputation that guys that play there go for 4 years. They're not going to sign their junior year. Well, I told him, I said, I'm signable, baby. I want to go play professional baseball. But the draft came and went, and I wasn't part of that. And there were like four guys on our team that did get drafted. It was a head scratcher, and I think a lot of times, especially in my baseball life, I've had to step back and reevaluate to some degree. First of all, check myself. Am I that good? Maybe I thought I was better than I really am. You know what I mean? But I do know this, that I did have an opportunity to go to Cape Cod. And I said, well, I'm going to go down there. I'm going to bust my butt. Actually was on a team, the Yarmouth-Dennis Red Sox, and Craig Biggio was the catcher on that team. I played shortstop. Of course, Craig Biggio ended up being a number one pick and a Hall of Famer. But when I left Cape Cod, because I did sign out of Cape Cod, I was down there for 2 weeks, and I can say that I was out hitting Biggio. He was hitting 185, and I think I was hitting 192. I happened to put in a pretty good weekend of baseball. Made some plays. Got to show off my arm a little bit. I think I actually got a couple hits to raise my average to 192. And guy whistled at me and said, hey, Mike, come on over here. And it was J.P. Ricciardi, who eventually ended up becoming a general manager in the major leagues. I believe he's still an assistant GM, or maybe an assistant somewhere, maybe with the Mets, I think. But he asked if I was interested in signing. He was a regional scout. They were down there to sign their fifth-round pick that was holding out. And, you know, he wasn't going to be completely upfront with me. Down the road, I found out that I was just a roster filler, because that year they had signed a kid named Darren Duffy, who was a first-round pick. The year before was a first-round pick named Walt Weiss, who ended up becoming the Rookie of the Year a couple years later.
Yeah.
So they were stockpiled. And you remember those Oakland A's team. There was no movement in the minor leagues. They had a great organization, don't get me wrong, but they were stockpiled at the major league level. Very rarely did young guys make it up, unless you were Rookie of the Year Walt Weiss, Rookie of the Year Mark McGuire, Rookie of the Year Jose Canseco, you know, that kind of caliber player. So it was tough to kind of break in. I digress a little bit, and I'll get back to the Oakland A's, but J.P. Ricciardi said, you know, I was wondering if you were interested in signing. I said, heck yeah, I'm interested. Can I make a few phone calls and talk to some people about this? He said, well, you got about 24 hours because we're going to fill this roster spot. I was like, are you kidding me? 24 hours, really? For a life-changing decision, potentially? You know, I didn't know what was ahead of me. I was very naive about anything beyond, at that moment, Cape Cod, right? So I did make a couple phone calls. One of the guys I talked to, his name was Mike Coots. He was a former player at the University of Maine. He had been drafted his junior year, turned down the draft, and never got drafted again. He went to tryouts, never even got an opportunity. And he wasn't much older than I. We never played in college together, but we played summer ball together a couple years before I went to Cape Cod. And he said, Borden, he says, you got to chase your dream, man. He says, make sure you get this done. Make sure they will pay for your final year of college, but then chase your dream, right? And I was like, yeah, that's pretty good. Pretty good advice from a guy that actually went through it. I never did call my college coach because he would have said, heck no, you got to come back, man. And to this day, God rest his soul, I know he frowns at me about that. But he appreciated going to the 1990 World Series when I was in it. Anyway. So
you get drafted in 86. Right?
I signed as a free agent in 1986, yes, sir. And I signed my contract in Worcester, Mass. The next day, was on a plane to Medford, Oregon, and was in rookie ball with the Oakland A's.
So tell us about your minor league experience. You're a minor leaguer until you're brought up in 1990. So yeah. You've got 86 and up to that. How was that? It must have been a huge change for you, life change.
Well, it was really interesting, okay? And I was still in the minor leagues at a time, and I know minor leagues are still very tough. I think they get paid a little bit more. My contract initially was $700 a month. When I landed in Medford, Oregon, my college roommate, Billy Reynolds, who was a senior, had been drafted by the Oakland A's. And he was in the batting cage, and I was like, Billy! Morty, what are you doing here? Man, I just signed. I signed out of Cape Cod. All right, where are you staying? I said, I don't know. I haven't got anything set up. They haven't talked to me about that. He goes, you want to stay with me? I said, absolutely. He goes, well, you're going to have to ride on the back of my bike. So he and his roommate had 10 speeds, and they were like 3 miles away. Okay. And they were staying at these houses that the YMCA put them up in. Trees growing through the windows, slugs and spiders in the corner of the room. They had no beds, just mattresses on the floor, no furniture or anything. It was the minor leagues through and through, right? And I loved it. I loved it. So, actually, like that week, I got a 10-speed bike. The suitcase that I was issued, hallelujah, had wheels because I could pull it behind my bike. I am not kidding you.
That's
true. This is a true story. It wasn't until the last week in Medford, Oregon, that I got my bike stolen. And I went into a jewelry store to buy my wife a birthday present. It was her birthday. She wasn't even my wife then. She was my college girlfriend. And I bought her a little ring. Came out, my bike was gone. I was like, are you kidding me? I got a week and you're stealing my bike. Anyway, I thought I had a pretty good year. I'm not exactly sure what I hit in Medford. I want to say maybe 240, 245. Made the plays, played the game the right way. Loved my coaches, loved my teammates. And had in my mind, golly, I feel like I played pretty well. I'm knocking on the door, baby. I am knocking on the door. I told you about my naivete. The next year, next spring, go to Scottsdale, Arizona. When I walked out on the field and I saw a sea of green and gold jerseys, I was like, oh my God, this is going to be a lot harder than I thought. I mean, every guy had that look in their eye. Like, we want to go to one place. And we'll do anything we can to get there, to the big leagues, right? And man, it kind of gives me chills just thinking about that. But, you know, I ended up getting put on what was considered, I guess, high A. At least that's what I always thought. Modesto, California in the Cal League. Played in Modesto for a year. And I climbed that proverbial ladder. I was fortunate enough to have a really solid year in 86. My manager was Tommy Reynolds. I made an all-star team in 1986. I played shortstop the whole year. Next year, I got promoted to double A. Tommy Reynolds got promoted to double A, and Tommy Reynolds said, he told me this, and I love him to death. He said, I pulled for you, man, but you can only be on this team as a utility player. So you have to learn how to play second base and third base. Whatever, baby, whatever it takes. The reason being, the number one pick Darren Duffy was the starting shortstop in AA. So I learned how to play second base. You know, I put my nose to the grindstone, took ground balls, started figuring some stuff out. First week in the season, Duffy dives in the hole, bam, thumb, lands on his thumb and has to get season-ending surgery on his thumb. I know, that's what I said. Now what are you going to do? Over to shortstop I go. Made the all-star team in AA. I was hitting like, it was unbelievable. And I had the weirdest stance too, and I'll share it with you. So I was hitting like over 300 halfway through the season. Made the all-star team. And before that season started, we were fortunate enough to, I don't know why, but a lot of the big league guys came down to the minor leagues. And I talked to Jose Canseco. I said, why do you have an open stance? He said, so I can see the pitcher. He goes, I felt like the standard stance, you know, where you're just standing straight up, everybody tells you to point your toes to the plate, you know, here. I felt like just my eyes were always straining. I just could never see. And I was like, dang, that's the way I feel, man. I opened up. Opened my stance up and got really low. I was about like this. Had the bat on my shoulder and had a flat bat through the zone. Stayed inside every ball, up the middle the other way, right? All summer long, hitting over 300, made the all-star team. All of a sudden, somebody caught wind of it. Our farm director, Carl Keel, the legendary Carl Keel, one of them. He's a hard-nosed, old-school dude. He comes down and he goes, what are you doing? That's a power hitter stance. It's Jose Canseco's stance, so it's a power hitter stance. I had no home runs. Why is this a power hitter stance? This is what minor league baseball is all about. It's a mental test. He told me to stand straight up. I want you to be more like playing pepper with the pitcher. My average just went, damn. It just went down, and it kept going down. The next year, I got called up to AAA. Same idea, utility player. I ended up playing a whole season, half at third, or half at short, half at second base. Hit about 230. I was a lost dog as a hitter. I mean, mentally, I started convincing myself, well, they said I was all glove, no bat. All glove, no bat. If there was ever an article written, Mike Bordick, he could catch it, but he can't hit it, right? Well, my saving grace came in 1990 when the lockout hit. Just like this year. The lockout hit, rosters expanded by two players. The third base coach on the Oakland A's in 1990 was Tommy Reynolds.
Your pal.
My pal, baby. I love him. Tony La Russa asked Tommy Reynolds, who in the minor leagues could catch the baseball because I need somebody to come in at the end of a ball game and make a play. He said, Mike Bordick is your guy. And I got an opportunity that year to play. Made the big league team in 1990. Shit my pants. Oh my God. Right? Unbelievable. It was just unbelievable. I didn't play a lot. After that first month of the season, they sent me back down to the minor leagues. They said, keep working hard, you know, try to figure out some stuff with the bat. Got called up in September. La Russa was more like, you know, we're going to play at the end of the ballgame again. If you get in there offensively, gold would be laying down a bunt, execute a hit and run. That was back when it was still in favor, right, to be able to do that kind of stuff. And that's when I felt like I was contributing a little bit. He actually, man, oh, man, I had a lot of hit and runs put on. One year I ended up leading the league with sacrifice bunts. 1991 came around. Wait. Go back in time to 1990. Did you have a question, Mike?
Well, in 1990, there was a World Series that your team was in.
That's what I was going back to.
Right.
So, at the end of September, La Russa calls me to the office and says, well, Mike, thanks for your help. We're heading to the postseason, and we don't need you. And I was like, all right, well, thanks for this opportunity. You know, I said, do you think I can go to the minor leagues, an instructional league, and make a hitting tape with one of my all-time heroes? Rick Burleson was the Orioles hitting coach in the minor leagues, the roving hitting guy. And he goes, that is a great idea. So I go to the instructional league, and I'm working out with Rick Burleson. I'm still taking my ground balls and stuff, you know, still working hard at it. And one afternoon, we're watching the playoffs, and I apologize for laughing, but watching the playoffs, and the A's are playing the Red Sox. Ellis Burks slides in to second base. It's a comebacker to Rick Honeycutt, flips it to the shortstop, Walt Weiss. Weiss gets taken out of second base and has to be carried off because he blew his knee out. I know. I know. After the game, there was a call to Instructional League in Scottsdale, Arizona. Is Bordick still down there? Yes, he is. Well, send him to Oakland. He's on the World Series roster. What? Yeah, I'm telling you, man. I'm telling you. Well, that was incredible. Played 1990 World Series. We played the Cincinnati Reds. Cincinnati Reds got hot and just destroyed the A's. A's were huge favorites. And we got swept 4-0. Rios was dominant. Mickey Hatcher had like 13 straight hits in 1990 World Series. But I got in 3 games. I didn't start at all, but I got in 3 games. And to this day, the greatest play I have ever made in my life, and it's a little bit of a drawn-out story, so bear with me. I'm sitting on the bench. It's like the 8th inning. Dang. What the heck is his name? I'm not sure. Anyway, the catcher, Ron Hassey. Our trainer comes down to the end of the bench. I am freezing. We're at Riverfront Stadium. I'm just like that. Oh, hey, Barry, what's up? Hey, if Hassey gets a hit, you're pinch running. Oh, okay. And I stand up. Crack. What? Base hit. Take my coat off. I go down to the end of the dugout. Tony, am I supposed to go pinch running? Yeah, you're pinch running. Oh, my gosh. Put my helmet on, I run down there, I get to first base, and I stand up first base, and our first base coach, Dave McKay, is like, okay, we got 2 outs, blah, 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 and I look up, and Rob Dimble is pitching.
Oh, God.
One of the nasty boys, throwing like 100 miles an hour. I was like, are you shitting me? I go like this. No, and he kicks off, he tries to pick me up, I'm like, ah!
Save?
Yes, yes. Anyway, ground ball, get out of the inning, I don't score, get up to second base, Gallego brings me my glove. Actually, it might have been Willie Randolph because Gallego, I think, was playing short. Hassey pinch hit for Gallego. I went out to shortstop. Willie Randolph brings my glove, which is pretty awesome, too. Willie Randolph, are you kidding me? And I go to short, and I think, oh, my gosh, I haven't even thrown a baseball yet. I haven't touched a baseball today. Well, I did earlier, but how the heck is this going to happen? And I look at McGuire, and I'm like, come on, come on. He doesn't even know. He's oblivious, really, to what's going on. I get one throw, and I think I, like, three-hopped it to him, right? I'm like, oh, my gosh. And listen, baseball players do a lot of self-talk. Sometimes they talk to other people. I was talking to God. I was praying for a lot of things. Please do not let me screw up out here. Please, I just felt the eyes of the whole world on me. Look at that freaking kid in short. Are you kidding me? We're going to abuse him. First batter, Eric Davis, who I will say this was one of my favorite teammates of all time when we came over to the Orioles. He hit me a ground ball. 3-hopper, right to me. How I made that play is only by God's grace. How it got over to first base of Mark McGuire, that's why I think it's the greatest play I have ever made. Out. And that was it. I think that was the only play I had all World Series, the first play of the first game I was in. So, yeah, that was one of my World Series great moments, and that is by far the greatest play I ever made.
So, Mike was 14 years in the big leagues. Is that right?
Yeah.
14 years. And that was year number one. For his career, the batting got a little better. Did you go back to the open stance? Because he had a lifetime average of 260, which not too bad. I mean, if you played today, you'd be an all-star.
Right? My God, I'd be excited with a 10-year deal.
So did you tinker with the stance?
That's a really good it's one of my favorite stories here. And I share this with a lot of kids about baseball. Because baseball is really all mental. You know, it really is. I think most of us in here probably play the game, you know. And sure, there might be some talent discrepancies here and there. But ultimately, it comes down to how you think. If you're confident, you're typically going to be pretty good, right? 1992, come into spring training, and we have a new hitting coach. At the time, well, not at the time, but when he played for the old Colt 45s, and he was considered the most feared player in all of baseball. And on a daily basis, he would tell us stories about how he used to beat the crap out of people. And one spring, he said, yeah, somebody cut me off, and I put my fist through the windshield, punched him right in the face, knocked him out, right at the light. I was like, oh my God. His name was Doug Rader.
Yeah.
Oh. Doug Rader, man. I mean, they called him the Rooster. He had a head like this big, big, mean son of a gun, right? Well, it was first or second week in spring training. He's like, Mike, get out. You got to talk to me about your hitting. I was like, oh, here we go. Trying to get in my head again, right? What are we going to do? He goes, tell me, when did you have the most success as a hitter, professional? And I said, Double A. I had an open stance. I said, and I threw Carl Keel on the bus, and I said, and then Carl Keel changed me, man. He says, well, why don't you take that up there? And we were playing an inter-squad game. Take that up there, let me take a look at it. So I got up, and I got the box, and I opened up. It's like, oh, here it is, man. It feels so good. And whack, I hit a hard ground ball at third base. Guy catches it, throws me out at first. And of course, on the way down, what do you think? As a baseball player, just all negative stuff comes into my head. Here we go again. Another hitting coach going to try to change me. Made another out, blah, blah, blah. Hit first base, got my head down, running back to the dugout. I look up, and I'm not kidding you, Doug Rader's eyes were as big as that big old bucket that he had. I mean, they were this big. And he says, we can work with that. Changed my life. Changed my life. That year, 1992, for 2 months in the big leagues, I may have been leading the league in hitting. I had a Kirby Puckett. I had a Griffey. I was hitting like 400. Are you kidding me? I ended up hitting 10th in the big leagues that year. Hit 300. Yeah, I know. And it was all because of we can work with that. And I just felt my chest just like, are you kidding me? Somebody believes in me? That's all it took, man.
So did you pretty much stay with that open stance?
I did, and yeah. I modified it a little bit. It's kind of funny. To be honest with you, I have no idea how it got to this point. But I do know this. A couple guys since have kind of copied my stance. But when I first started, I told y'all, my stance was like this. Opened up, bat on the shoulder. By the time the season started, this was really bizarre. And like I said, I have no idea how this happened. I was open, and my bat was right here.
Really?
And I just rested it like this. And when the pitcher went into his windup, I was just almost like I was taking a nap. I was just like this. And then I'd kind of step in to get my rhythm. And then, boom. Now, I wasn't trying to do a ton with the ball. Still trying to stay inside the baseball, drive it the other way.
Did that work for you?
Absolutely. It calmed me down. Right the next year, Jay Buhner adopted that. He ended up hitting like 40 home runs. But a lot of guys, remember Tony Batista who played here?
Yeah.
He had that kind of same thing. And he and I played together, and he stole that stuff from me. I should have patented that stance. But no, it worked. Like I said, I hit 300. And I kind of ended up modifying it a little bit because I felt like I was getting stronger. And, you know, when I ended up coming to the Orioles, I had some of the best power hitting years of my career.
Right. Well, and it winds up for a career 45 RBIs a year, 6 homers a year, and then there's the glove part of it. He set major league records for most games without an error by a shortstop, 110, and let me see what my note says, and chances, 543 before an error came your way. That must have been pretty special. And the glove is in Cooperstown, you told me.
Yeah, the glove. Yeah, I do have one glove at home, but the other glove, after I broke that record, they asked for it in Cooperstown, which is pretty cool,
yeah.
Right? And so some people, like, they call me, hey, Mike, I heard your gloves at Cooperstown, but I didn't see it. So they don't keep it out all the time. Are you kidding me? But I don't know, once a year they might bring it out. But an interesting story about that, and of course there is a lot of luck involved. I had some great first baseman. Of course, Palmeiro, Jeff Conine was there, David Segee, digging some balls out of the dirt. And I guess it was around the 50th game or so, we were playing Houston, and there was a ball hit up the middle, and it was this kind of a soft little liner, and I tried to get it on the short hop, and B.J. Ryan was pitching, and B.J. had kind of scuffled a little bit before he became dominant, and a couple runs ended up scoring, and I want to say, Step, was it you that I asked the scorekeeper to change it? Yeah, I think Bill Stetko over here is our PR guy. I said, Step, you got to change that. That should be an error. I mean, I wasn't thinking about any kind of extended errorless streaks or anything. 50 is pretty dang good. I would always try to go 10 days. That would be my thing. Let's try to do 10-day blocks and see what happens. Well, the scorekeeper didn't want to change it, so he gave the guy a hit. And ended up playing along, and next thing I know, the next year I'm in Toronto. And it's, I don't know, I guess I completed 110 games without an error. And I got a start at short in Toronto early on in the season. And what you know is the same exact ball. A little soft line drive up the middle. Cut over, try to get the short hop. Felt bad, missed it. So that ball gave me a little bit of trouble. Error on the board. And I was like, there you go. Comes around and gets me at the end. So, but I felt really, I guess, I don't know, a culmination of a lot of things, singularity of purpose. When you try to work as hard as you can at fielding ground balls the right way, I think good things ultimately will happen. I always kind of, I took some things defensively, maybe a little bit more serious than other guys. I'm not saying there weren't great fielders, obviously all through the big leagues, but when I saw an infielder like flip a ball behind his back in practice or between his legs, I felt in my mind that I had an advantage.
Right.
Because I didn't do that in practice. When I practiced, I took the old, you know, Cal Ripken senior philosophy. Try to be as perfect as you can, you know, and I tried to be as perfect as I could. Every time I fielded a ground ball, and I think I was rewarded with that little streak at the end of my career. I was 35, mind you, so but still able to move around out there at shortstop and kind of took care of myself to some degree.
Yeah. So you alluded to the fact that the Orioles, so you come to Baltimore in 1997. I was just thinking back about that team, and I want to talk about his impact in coming over in 97, but that team had 14 players off that roster in 97 made All-Star games from time to time, or in some cases a lot of times, you know, but they had that. There were eight guys from that team who were in the Orioles Hall of Fame, and there were four players who were in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. They were loaded. But maybe the biggest story for us, Baltimore fans, is that he comes over, a heralded shortstop, and Ripken moves to third base. Tell us about that. What kind of pressure was that? Was there pressure or not?
You know, yeah, there was pressure. No doubt about that. And I think I underestimated that pressure. What happens, I'll tell you what happened with me. In the off season, I started being courted to some degree by, God dang, come on, man. Stay with me. Who's the GM at that time?
Was it Heeman?
No, it wasn't Heeman.
Pat Gillick.
Yeah. Thank you. Pat Gillick asked if, you know, started talking to my agent, asked if I was interested in coming over. And initially, like everybody's response, no way. Cal's a shortstop. Cal's, you know, greatest shortstop ever and this and that. And so it didn't even really kind of cross my mind that I would even do that. But down the road, I ended up meeting with Pat Gillick. And it was almost as if he said, and I think he did say this, it's going to happen with or without you. This move will, you know, Cal's going to go to third base. We think that you can handle that. we would like you to be a part of our team. And, you know, there weren't a lot of teams knocking my door down. I was finally a free agent, you know, the Oakland A's. I played 6 years there. Historically, the Oakland A's, you know, they signed each guy to a one-year contract. Everybody started moving on. La Russa was in St. Louis. McGuire left. Terry Steinbach left. New ownership. They completely dismantled the Oakland A's. And there was a guy that ended up coming to Baltimore that was a minor leaguer at the time with Oakland. His name was Miguel Tejada. So he was kind of pushing an older shortstop out anyway. And they never even asked me about second base. So Kansas City showed some interest, and Bob Boone, I think, was a manager at that time. And they, you know, kind of coming out and said, we really want you to play in Kansas City. And, you know, as I started all of a sudden evaluating all this, saying, okay, this is pretty serious right now. Go to Kansas City, middle of the country. You know, I just didn't foresee them as being a championship caliber team. Baltimore had just gone in the postseason in 1996, you know, when kid took the home run away, or the out away, excuse me, the out away. And it just seemed like they were poised. Mike just listed off, you know, a number of the All-Stars, the Hall of Famers that were on that team. An incredible pitching, Scott Erickson, Mike Mussina. I mean, the list goes on. Randy Myers was, you know, certainly one of the better closers in the game at the time. And I just think I got to a point where I said, because when I came up with Oakland, I'm sorry I'm jumping around a little bit. When I came up with Oakland, they were a dynasty. They were in the World Series in 88. They won it in 89. Back to the World Series in 1990. You know, went to the postseason in 92, got beat by the Blue Jays, who ended up winning 2 years in a row. I just felt like that's where baseball players needed to be, in the postseason, always playing for something special. Now, was there another little something on the end of that, replacing, moving Cal Ripken over to third base, right? Yeah, and I had to, I did some really deep soul searching, and I said, listen, man, that's what this is all about. That's what your journey is all about, to try to take on challenges, you know, and try to overcome. And so I talked myself into it, set up a press conference in Baltimore, and my wife and I had a layover in Pittsburgh before we came to Baltimore, and on one of the seats in the Pittsburgh airport was a newspaper, the Washington Post, and my picture was on the cover, and I was like, honey, look at this! Are you kidding me? This is going to be awesome. Started reading the article, and it abused me. Why is Mike Wardick coming to Baltimore? Mike Wardick is no more than a glorified Billy Ripken, is really what they said. How can he move Cal Ripken over to third base? And just Ripken, and I'm not kidding you, got right on the phone with my agent. I said, I don't think this is going to happen. I don't think they don't want me like you guys said they did. I just read this article. John Maroon was the PR guy. We talked to him too. He said, no, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. He's this guy's just blowing smoke. There's a couple people, you know, that are upset that Cal's moving over third base, this and that. Well, that didn't really set well with me because I like positive, you know, stuff. I knew there was going to be some adversity, but I hated it. I went up to the top, seeing my picture, and then right to the bottom of the basement after seeing it. The press conference went well. Spring training went well. I loved the team. My teammates were awesome. Cal was great with everything. We played catch every day. Cal and I played catch every day. Like, really? I'm your catch partner? All right. This is cool, right? So he made me feel comfortable. He taught me a lot about our pitchers. In many ways, helped me defensively. Not necessarily with how to catch a ball, but positioning-wise. Many times we just play off him at third base. And I think we developed a pretty good relationship. Problem was, when the first day I stepped in Camden Yards, And Camden Yards back in the 90s was just straight, you were a rock star, period. It sold out every night. Place was jumping. You know, I got great applause coming down the orange carpet. We were playing the Indians. My first at bat, and here we go. This is how baseball goes again, how it gets in your head, right? First at bat, I'm feeling good, had a strong spring training. I hit a ball in the hole. Brady's on first base. I think I was hitting second, actually. I feel like I was. Brady's on first base. I hit a ball in the hole. Frickin' Omar Vizquel makes a dive and play. Brady rounded second, thinking that it was going to the outfield. They throw him out at second base. So my first at bat, I didn't get a hit. And if I would have gotten hit, I'm telling you right now, I probably would have hit 350 then. But I didn't. I started pressing. And man, oh man. I will remind you guys, because some of you probably do remember, for 2 months I hit like 150. Oh, it was terrible. It was terrible. I was more of an emotional wreck for 2 months in Baltimore, the first 2 months, than I'd ever been in my life. Sleeping pills, Bud Light, I mean, oh my gosh, couldn't sleep. I mean, it was crazy. I was stressed out. And then one day, Sam Perlazzo, he comes out to me, and I'm like, I guess I lost a little bit of hair at that time, too. Sam puts his arm around me, and he says, Borden, you just got to relax, man. Why do you think you're here? Because you relax, and you just play the game, have fun playing it. I don't know, it helped a little bit. I ended up doing all right. I think I hit like 236 that year after starting 2 months at 150 or 180. Had a great playoff run, playing the Mariners. I know Jeff Rebley, obviously pretty famous for hitting off Randy Johnson, but I hit over 400 in that playoff series. But there again, I thought, here we go, man, we're going to be a dynasty. We got beat by the Indians, but I thought we were going to be there for a long, long time. And I didn't realize that we were going to go south in a hurry.
Yeah, the last game of that season here in Baltimore, some of you, I'm sure, remember that. Mussina pitches a gem. We get into the ninth inning, I guess, and Armando Benitez comes in and out goes the home run, and we were gone. That was it. This juggernaut team that the Orioles had put together.
Yeah, I have a little insight. Mike Hargrove was the manager of the Indians. He ended up coming over managing the Orioles. One day we're sitting down there just talking ball, talking shop in the dugout, and we're talking about the playoffs. And he goes, oh, yeah, well, we had Armando's pitches. Oh. I was like, what are you talking about? He said he was tipping his slider. I said, what? I almost started crying. I was like, are you kidding me? Well, Marquise Grissom had a 3-run homer in that home series off a slider, and then Tony Fernandez hit the ball up in the flag court on a slider. Wow. Nobody was touching Armando's fastball, right? But Armando, I'm not going to blame anything on Armando. Just like Scott Erickson, they thought their sliders were nasty when they could just win baseball games with just their fastball. Erickson had the turbo sinker, and Armando had the 100 miles an hour, you know, right above the belt. And not too many guys could turn that around. Especially when Armando would turn around and look at the speed, and they would say 100, take his hat off and go like that to get the crowd going. Oh, my God. But, yeah, they picked up a slider, and they didn't miss it.
So, midway through, or at some point in the 0-0 season, you go over to the Mets, and Melvin Moore shows up over here.
Yeah.
In the trade. But then you come back to the Orioles for 0-1 and 0-2, and tell us about those last couple of years here.
Yeah, well, 2000, it was the best baseball I'd ever played in my life. I had 16 home runs before the All-Star break. Yeah, unbelievable. And I know, well, it was just out of the 90s, so I wasn't taking steroids. I did not take steroids. As a matter of fact, I was voted by one of the local radio stations as the number one player that should have taken steroids. But anyway, so playing really good baseball helped get me traded, but traded to a World Series potential contender. Getting on the New York Mets was awesome, an awesome experience. We ended up having a great run, played with more great players. I mean, really what makes baseball are the teams you're on. Talked about some of the Baltimore Orioles teams with great Hall of Famers. You know, obviously Cal, Robbie, Harold Baines, you know, and the list goes on. But even out in Oakland, think about Eckersley, Ricky Henderson. I mean, my gosh. And Seiko McGuire, just incredible players. And then going over to the Mets, Al Leiter, Mike Hampton pitching, had Robin Ventura over third base, had a nice young team as well. So great team to be a part of, and pretty cool to play at Shea Stadium and be a part of that, because as much I see that Yankee hat back there, it makes me want to throw up, but I'll tell you what, playing in New York City, man, if you're going good, wow, do they love it. It is incredible, and I just love my experience playing for the New York Mets. Bobby Valentine is the manager, and got to go to another World Series. Yeah, it was pretty intense. And that was the Subway Series, of course, and so much fun to be a part of that. What I remember most about that Subway Series is how when we would go from Shea Stadium over to Yankee Stadium, they'd shut down the whole highway and stuff, and people would be, it was awesome because everybody would be lined up on the highway. Some people be flipping you off, and other people saying, "Let's go Mets," you know, stuff like that. Oh, it was incredible. So I really enjoyed that experience. But yeah, after that year, I came right back to Baltimore and played a couple seasons. Had some unfortunate injuries. I got taken out of second base, separated my shoulder. I guess in 2001, and then, or maybe it was vice versa. Maybe it was 2002, but. The year that I ended up setting that defensive fielding record, I slid into second base, back when you could break up double plays, and I broke up a double play, but I broke my kneecap sliding into the guy at second base, so I missed a month with that. But, you know, I always loved my experience playing in Baltimore. Fans were incredible. Camden Yards was sold out every night. Just love baseball, and it's nice to see them coming back and seeing some really good baseball right now. I truly enjoy watching the Orioles play. They're such an exciting team to watch. Whether or not they make it to the postseason, obviously yet to be seen, but, man, they don't disappoint as far as the brand of baseball they're flipping out there, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, that's for sure. Now, listen, we're going to hard stop at 3. We have time for a couple of questions. We'll go right here.
Thank you. Yeah, you talked about your open stance. I noticed that back in the 80s, Walt Weiss and Carney Landsberg and Canseco and McGuire, everybody sort of changed the entire look of batting at that time. Everyone had their full on right to the pitcher and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Was it Weiss that started it? Was there a coach that started it?
Jeez, you know, that's a great question. And I don't really know because – you know, for years, even growing up, now, the team I used to watch as a young kid were the Dodgers. And, you know, like Steve Garvey, he used to be the guy I used to hit like. Stand straight like this, hands up here. And that's either you hit straight like that or you closed your stance,
yeah,
right? Kind of dove into the plate. Now, I'm not exactly sure if there was a hitting coach. I do know this, that every time a hitting coach came to Oakland, they were only there 1 year. So I don't know who would have had that much influence on opening guys up. Carney Lansford was a great veteran and a great leader. And I know he always had that kind of open stance where he was kind of here, kind of shake his hands like that.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of guys might have adopted it from him, you know, so.
Okay. Next question over here.
You said you played for the World Series, the National League pennant winning Mets. What was your reaction or whatever when Roger Clemens threw that jagged piece of bat at Mike Piazza?
Well, incredible history there, obviously. You know, Clemens had hit Piazza in the head that year, knocked him out right at home plate. And then for that to happen, I think, well, my reaction was, let's go, let's beat the crap out of the Yankees. but I think we were all hoping that if Piazza would have charged the mound, the Yankees would have been done. That's what I think. And, but he didn't. And, of course, there was a lot of talk about that. And I'm not saying that Piazza should have charged him out or anything like that. I do know that there is an incredible intensity in those games. And Clemens probably wasn't throwing it at him. Maybe not, though. Maybe not. But, yeah, I thought that that could have been a turning point where the Mets, you know, took over, you know, beat the Yankees. But it just didn't happen. But it did rub everybody the wrong way. It did not have a good look to it, right? And, yeah.
All right, we'll take one back here.
Mike, can you talk for a minute about one of your post-career jobs, coaching high school baseball at a school where lacrosse was king, and baseball was not even in the picture when you got there?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking that. When I got done playing baseball, I finished my degree. I did not do it as promised back after 1986 when I got college paid for. I dedicated my life to baseball. So when my career was over, I went back and got my degree and actually marched with the class of 2006 at the University of Maine. And I got an education. Two of my sons, actually I had four kids actually going to Boys Latin at that time. I went to Boys Latin and I asked if I could teach and coach. And they, of course, said, well, we don't have any teaching positions, but you can coach our baseball team if you want. So I did, and hoping that there would be an opening and I would get into education like I had hoped. The first year had a really good team, full of a lot of talented junior players, and we went to the state championship. We got beat. The next year we went back to the state championship and we won. I was only there for 2 years. It was really exciting for me to actually hoist the trophy. It's the first time I'd ever won the championship.
Yep.
And I told my kids that too. And I wasn't a good coach. I didn't do anything extreme. As a matter of fact, I think the reason why I may have been looked at as a good coach at that time is because I didn't get in their way. I let these kids play. And we had six seniors on that team. Four of them went on to college and played. One of them, Austin Knight, got drafted by the Orioles, was in the Orioles organization for a few years. So we had incredibly talented players. I didn't have a lot of coaching, you know, stuff to throw at these kids. Occasionally I might have, you know, taught them how to field a ground ball, this and that. But it was fun to watch them. It was fun to be a part of it and fun to actually win a championship. The next year, the reason I didn't come back is because the Toronto Blue Jays asked if I would be their roving infield instructor. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like a cool thing to do. So I ended up being the roving infield instructor for Blue Jays for a year. After that, the Orioles asked if I would come over and be the roving infield instructor. So I did that for a couple years. And I really loved coaching. I appreciate every minute being on the field with guys, trying to help them get better. You know, especially younger players that have that eye of tiger, you know, they'll do whatever, their ears and eyes are open, you know, they're impressionable. When you try to coach a big league guy, they're like, are you kidding me? But minor league guys, you can have an impact to really kind of help them out. So that was a lot of fun going through the minor leagues, helping instruct some baseball. Whether or not I ever get back into high school baseball, I'm not sure. I do have my youngest son is at Boys Latin, he's a sophomore, and he's hoping to help hoist the trophy there next year.
Well, Morty, I think we're going to have to leave it there.
Thank you so much for coming. Thank you all of you. And I hope you have a great rest of your time. Thank you. Thank you all very much.
He did it well.